It was carved from the earth by tectonic fury, divided by empire, and reclaimed by blood. Panama isn't just a country, it's a corridor of power, a prize fought over by kings, colonizers, drug lords, and superpowers. For centuries, outsiders controlled its destiny. But this is the story of how a nation fought to reclaim its voice through betrayal, revolution, dictatorship, and defiance. From gold routes to gunfire, from canal riots to climate battles, this is the untold saga of Panama, the land between two oceans, and the people who refuse to be a bridge for others while going nowhere themselves. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Panama, A Journey Through Time, Episode 4. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 13, Democracy in the Ashes. When the dictator fell, the fires did not go out. Smoke lingered in the alleys of El Chorrillo. Rubble still smoldered. Craters from tank shells marked once familiar streets. And the silence that followed the last burst of gunfire was not peace. It was a country stunned into breathlessness. Freedom had come, yes, but it came at a cost Panama would be counting for years. January 1990. Manuel Noriega was gone, spirited away to a Miami courtroom, his face blinking across televisions around the world like a captured phantom. He had ruled through silence, surveillance, and secrets. Now, Panama stood blinking in the sunlight of a new era. But what exactly had it inherited? A nation shattered. The U.S. invasion, Operation Just Cause, had ended the Noriega regime, but it left a gaping wound. Panama City, especially neighborhoods like El Chorrillo, lay in ruins. Bombed during the early hours of the attack, entire blocks were reduced to ash. Families searched for relatives under collapsed walls. Children wandered through smoking alleyways in torn pajamas. The air was filled with grief, fury, and disbelief. Official U.S. figures estimated around 500 Panamanian deaths. But independent investigators, NGOs, and Panamanian witnesses insisted the number was far higher, closer to 2,000, perhaps more. The truth remains elusive. Mass graves were rumored. Bodies were buried hurriedly. Some were never found at all. For many, Noriega's crimes had made his removal necessary. But the method, military invasion, foreign boots, civilian casualties, felt like liberation through occupation. Panamanians emerged into a dawn they did not entirely trust. The American stay. In the weeks after the invasion, U.S. forces remained in Panama under the banner of restoring order. They helped with basic services, clearing rubble, providing emergency food, restoring electricity. But their presence was uneasy. Armed soldiers patrolled streets. Checkpoints divided neighborhoods. Surveillance towers loomed above burned-out buildings. To some, these soldiers were heroes. To others, they were occupiers. The old fears resurfaced. Had Panama really gained its freedom, or had it simply traded one form of control for another? Endara's shaky inheritance. The U.S. had declared that the purpose of the invasion was to restore democracy. And, in terms of optics, they moved quickly. Guillermo Endara, a soft-spoken lawyer and politician who had technically won the May 1989 presidential election before it was annulled by Noriega, was sworn in at a U.S. military base the night of the invasion. He appeared on TV, wearing pajamas, hastily awakened and ushered into leadership by American hands. It was a surreal image, a new president of a free Panama, sworn in not on Panamanian soil, but on foreign territory. Even Endara knew the optics were poor. But he pressed forward. His administration faced overwhelming challenges. A collapsed economy. The banking sector was paralyzed, public trust in institutions shattered. Mass displacement. Thousands were homeless in El Chorrillo and surrounding areas. A broken military. The Panama Defense Forces, PDF, had been dismantled. Many former officers were in hiding or imprisoned. The country had no security apparatus beyond U.S. troops. Public trauma. The population was in mourning, confused, and emotionally raw. Some grieved for the fallen. Others mourned a nation that no longer felt like theirs. Endara promised healing and democracy. but he faced a country scarred and fractured. The struggle to rebuild institutions. Reconstructing Panama wasn't just about buildings. It was about rebuilding belief in laws, in leadership, in the fragile concept of a civilian-led democracy. The judiciary had been stacked with loyalists under Noriega. Judges were seen as corrupt or cowardly. Reforms were slow and resisted from within. Trials against former Noriega officials stalled or collapsed. Witnesses disappeared. Files went missing. The press, once muzzled, now exploded into action. Newspapers printed exposés, demanded transparency, and criticized the government for its dependence on the U.S. military. But they also struggled with funding, and some were accused of spreading misinformation or sowing division. Civil society, nonprofits, churches, student unions filled the vacuum, organizing everything from food distribution to town hall meetings. They became the new moral conscience of Panama, reminding the country of what it had lost and what it could still gain. The end of the military. Perhaps the most radical transformation came in 1994 when Panama formally abolished its standing military. Instead, the country created the Panamanian National Police, PNP, a civilian force under democratic control. It was a bold experiment, almost unheard of in a region plagued by coups, juntas, and military interference. The message was clear: never again. Never again would a general hold the nation hostage. Never again would intelligence agencies spy on citizens. Never again would power be claimed through uniforms instead of ballots. It was a gamble, and it carried risks, especially with organized crime and narco-trafficking rising across Latin America. But Panama stuck to it, and slowly, the gamble began to pay off. Democracy, wounded but breathing. Through the 1990s, Panama held free and fair elections, first under Endara, then Ernesto Perez Baladares, 1994, and later Mireya Moscoso, 1999, the country's first female president. Each administration faced challenges: corruption, inequality, unemployment, but none repeated the sins of the past. The military stayed out of politics. The press remained free. The judiciary, while flawed, began tentative reforms. Internationally, Panama rebuilt its reputation. It rejoined regional trade pacts, secured investment, and worked with foreign powers on anti-drug efforts. The economy stabilized, driven by banking, services, and canal-related logistics. But beneath the surface, wounds lingered. Families of invasion victims demanded justice and recognition. The government hesitated, fearing diplomatic tensions with the U.S. It would take years before public acknowledgement and symbolic reparations would even be considered. Still, for the first time in generations, Panama was steering its own course. The road to the canals returned. Even as democracy took root, one reality remained unchanged. The Panama Canal was still controlled by the United States. According to the Torrijos-Carter Treaties signed in 1977, the full transfer of the canal would not occur until December 31, 1999. For nearly a decade after the invasion, this looming handover became a national obsession. The government established the Panama Canal Authority, trained engineers, and prepared to take over. The schools taught canal history with renewed vigor. Songs were written. Streets were renamed. A generation of children who had never known anything but foreign control were being taught that the canal, the artery through which the world flowed, would finally belong to them. Democracy born in ashes. By the end of the 1990s, Panama was a different nation. It was no longer afraid, though it remembered everything. It was no longer silenced, though it still struggled to speak clearly. It was no longer ruled by force, though the memory of dictatorship remained close enough to touch. Democracy had not come from ballots alone. It had come from funerals, from broken glass, from parents whispering the names of disappeared loved ones, from the ruins of El Chorrillo, from the shattered windows of the presidential palace, from the empty cells beneath the military barracks, and from the streets where ordinary people dared to raise their voices. The flame of freedom, once nearly extinguished, now flickered steadily. And it would burn even brighter when the canal, the nation's spine, scar, and crown, finally came home. Chapter 15, Canal Capital, Panama in the 21st Century. It began with a flag raised over a canal, a new millennium, a promise of self-determination. But what happens after sovereignty? What does a country do when it finally holds the keys to its future? Panama, reborn in the year 2000, had everything to gain and everything to lose. It was no longer defined by what was taken. It would now be defined by what it built. The canal was no longer the dominion of a foreign power. But the moment it became Panamanian, it also became something else. A litmus test for competence, for governance, for justice, and for the soul of a nation trying to walk the tightrope between past trauma and future ambition. From gateway to global player. After the full transfer of the canal on December 31, 1999, Panama entered the 21st century with momentum. The Autoridad del Canal de Panama, ACP, quickly earned global respect by maintaining, then expanding, canal operations with professionalism, transparency, and innovation. Billions in revenue flowed into national coffers, turning Panama into one of Latin America's fastest-growing economies through the early 2000s and 2010s. The country pivoted from being merely a transit zone to becoming a logistics powerhouse. Ports at Colón and Balboa were modernized, turning Panama into a key node in global shipping. The Panama Pacífico Special Economic Area attracted multinational corporations, offering tax incentives and proximity to the canal. Tocumen International Airport expanded, transforming Panama City into an aviation hub that connected the Americas. The Panama Canal expansion, completed in 2016, allowed for the passage of Neo-Panamax ships, nearly tripling cargo capacity. For the first time, Panama wasn't just a pathway for global trade. It was central to it. The rise of the skyline. Panama City evolved into a metropolis of concrete, glass, and ambition. In just two decades, its skyline exploded, a forest of gleaming towers rising along the Cinta Costera, casting mirrored reflections over the Pacific. By 2020, the city boasted more high-rise buildings than any other Central American capital. Skyscrapers bore the names of banks, insurance firms, and international conglomerates. Entire districts like Costa del Este emerged from former mangroves, master-planned and manicured, populated by corporate headquarters and luxury condominiums. International architects competed to design gravity-defying structures, from twisted towers to spaceship-like residential complexes. For the business elite, it was a golden age. For global investors, Panama became a magnet for capital. For the government, it was a symbol, proof that Panama could thrive without its colonial overseers. But while the skyline soared, the street level told a more complicated story. Two Panamas. In the hills above the city, in rural provinces like Darien, Ngay Bugle, and parts of Colón, entire communities remained locked out of prosperity. Despite the GDP growth, Panama remained one of the most unequal countries in the Americas. The Gini coefficient, a measurement of income inequality, consistently placed Panama near the top of Latin America's wealth gap rankings. In the capital, penthouses overlooked infinity pools and private helipads. In the countryside, families lived without running water or electricity. In San Miguelito and Arajan, the sprawling barrios surrounding the capital, unemployment and gang activity surged. Indigenous communities, still guarding ancestral land, struggled for legal protections, educational access, and cultural survival. This contrast became the central paradox of post-canal Panama. How could a country so rich still be so poor? And as each container ship passed through the canal, earning fees measured in millions, ordinary Panamanians asked, "Where is our share?" The ghosts of corruption. With wealth came temptation. The very institutions that had upheld the canal's success soon found themselves surrounded by scandal. In 2009, President Ricardo Martinelli was elected on promises of anti-corruption and business savvy. By 2015, he was being investigated for illegal wiretapping, embezzlement, and public contract fraud. The Odebrecht scandal, a sprawling international bribery case involving the Brazilian construction giant, ensnared multiple Panamanian officials, past and present. whistleblowers, journalists, and civil society leaders exposed a deep culture of impunity, in which elite families, politicians, and corporate interests operated above the law. The irony was suffocating. Panama had taken back the canal with pride, but was now losing public trust to its own elites. And yet, the country still moved forward. Panama Papers and global fallout. In 2016, the world's attention once again turned to Panama, this time not for its locks and logistics, but for its secrets. The Panama Papers, a leak of 11.5 million documents from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca, exposed how the global elite used offshore tax havens to hide wealth, avoid taxation, and launder money. The revelations touched prime ministers, royalty, athletes, corporations, and even heads of state. While many of the entities involved were international, the brand damage to Panama was immediate and profound. Critics called Panama a paradise for secrecy and shell companies. Tourism dipped, investors hesitated, and the government scrambled to defend its financial sector. Reforms followed, more transparency, tougher financial regulations, and a rebranding campaign to reassert Panama's legitimacy. But the scandal revealed an uncomfortable truth. Panama, for all its success, still operated in gray zones, still walked the line between opportunity and exploitation. Voices from the street. Amid the skyscrapers and scandals, Panama's citizens kept pushing. In 2019, mass protests erupted over constitutional reforms that many believed would protect politicians from prosecution. Tens of thousands marched in Panama City, waving banners that read, "No es tuyo, es del pueblo." It's not yours, it belongs to the people. Youth movements, fueled by social media and political art, demanded better public services, environmental protection, and transparency. Indigenous communities staged blockades and hunger strikes to defend their land against mining concessions and illegal logging. Democracy, while imperfect, was alive. Panamanians were no longer just spectators. They were participants, shaping the future with every vote, every mural, every protest. Climate and the canal. As the 2020s unfolded, a new existential threat emerged: climate change. The Panama Canal, dependent on fresh water from Lake Gatun, began to suffer from prolonged droughts. Decreased rainfall threatened transit capacity, delayed shipping, and forced ships to carry lighter loads. In response, the ACP launched sustainability initiatives, new reservoir projects, investment in water conservation and rainwater capture, exploration of desalination technologies, transitioning to carbon-neutral canal operations. Panama also signed major climate accords, positioning itself as a green logistics leader. But the challenges were urgent and complex. The same canal that had made Panama rich could become its liability in a warming world. And yet, the country pressed on, the pulse of a nation reimagined. Today, Panama stands at a crossroads, not of oceans, but of ideas. It is a country with one of the most advanced financial sectors in the region, a growing middle class, yet enduring poverty, a celebrated history of resistance, yet an ongoing struggle with transparency, a powerful canal, yet a vulnerable climate. Panama is still writing its story, still reconciling who it was with who it wants to become. Its future depends not just on trade routes or treaties, but on how well it listens to its people, on whether it can close the gap between skyline and shantytown, on whether it can honor its past without being trapped by it, and on whether it can finally become not just a canal country, but a country complete. Chapter 16, The Future of the Isthmus. History is not a straight line. It is a tide that retreats and returns, carving the same stone in new ways. And here, where two continents meet and oceans breathe side by side, the land has always carried the tension of movement. Panama was born of pressure, and pressure, once again, is shaping its future. At the beginning of this story, Panama was a strip of land forged by tectonic upheaval, its existence altering the very rhythm of life on Earth. Now, more than 3 million people call this narrow bridge home. And as the 21st century unfolds, Panama stands not only at the crossroads of geography, but at the intersection of enormous existential decisions. What kind of nation will Panama become? How will it carry its past into the future? What legacy will it leave behind for its people and for the world? The weight of history. Panama's history is uniquely heavy. It carries the echoes of conquerors, the blood of martyrs, the shadows of dictators, and the triumphs of reclaimed sovereignty. Its story is one of resilience in the face of exploitation, survival in the grip of empire, and self-determination clawed back inch by inch. But sovereignty is not static. It must be maintained not just in treaties or parades, but in everyday governance, in justice that functions, in institutions that serve rather than extract, in education that uplifts, and in leadership that listens. Panama reclaimed its canal. Now it must reclaim its civic soul. Challenges on the horizon. Panama's path forward is neither easy nor guaranteed. The country faces a constellation of challenges that require clarity, courage, and creativity. 1. Climate vulnerability. Panama is blessed and burdened by geography. Its biodiversity is extraordinary, but so is its exposure to environmental instability. The Panama Canal, reliant on freshwater reservoirs, is under mounting pressure from droughts and changing rainfall patterns. Sea level rise threatens low-lying urban districts and vulnerable coastal communities. Deforestation in Darien and other regions weakens ecological resilience and invites illicit activities like narco-trafficking and illegal mining. Panama has taken steps, like declaring its intention to become carbon neutral by 2050. But the clock is ticking. The isthmus that once divided oceans must now unite ecosystems, protecting the delicate web of life that sustains it. 2. Deep inequality. Despite robust GDP growth and global investment, wealth in Panama remains concentrated among the few. Indigenous populations face disproportionately high poverty rates, limited healthcare access, and underfunded schools. Urban areas like San Miguelito and rural provinces like Bocas del Toro struggle with underemployment and public neglect. Corruption continues to siphon funds away from public services. The question for the future is not just how much Panama grows, but who benefits. A canal that enriches elites but bypasses communities is no longer a symbol of pride. It becomes a new form of exclusion. 3. Democratic fragility. Panama has made great strides since the Noriega era. Elections are free, press freedom exists, and civil society is active. But the system is far from perfect. Voter disillusionment is high. Political parties often appear disconnected from citizens' needs. High-profile corruption cases have resulted in few convictions. Mistrust in public institutions remains widespread. A democracy cannot survive on memory alone. It must be renewed, reimagined, and reinvigorated for each generation. 4. Geopolitical crosscurrents. Panama's central location makes it a stage for global competition. The U.S. remains an influential partner, but no longer the only one. China has expanded its footprint in Panama through trade, infrastructure projects, and diplomatic ties. The European Union, Japan, and regional powers like Mexico and Brazil all seek strategic access through Panama's ports, financial networks, and logistical corridors. Panama must navigate these alliances carefully, not as a pawn, but as a player. Its foreign policy must balance investment with sovereignty, partnership with independence. Opportunities to shape the 21st century. Despite the pressure, Panama is uniquely positioned to be a regional leader and global innovator if it leans into its strengths. 1. Green logistics and eco-innovation. With the canal and advanced ports, Panama can become a model for sustainable commerce, developing carbon-neutral shipping zones, green ports, and circular economy frameworks that turn trade into a tool for climate healing rather than degradation. 2. Tech and digital transformation. Panama's growing tech scene, fueled by investments in fintech, blockchain, and cybersecurity, can turn it into a digital capital of the Americas. If channeled properly, these tools can increase government transparency, improve access to remote education and healthcare, create decentralized opportunities outside Panama City. 3. Cultural reclamation and education. Panama is a cultural crossroads, rich in Afro-Caribbean, indigenous, mestizo, and immigrant traditions. Its future depends on teaching that truth, not as a footnote, but as a foundation, rewriting curriculums to center the Ngay Bugle, Guna, and Afro-Panamanian histories, preserving languages, dances, oral traditions, and community leadership, promoting intercultural dialogue that heals historic fractures. The future of Panama is not skyscrapers. It is shared memory and shared dignity. The next generation. More than half of Panama's population is under 30. They have grown up post-Noriega, post-invasion, and post-canal transfer. Their identity is not defined by colonial trauma, but it is shaped by its echoes. They know the slogans, but they want substance. They are online, global, and watching. They are asking, why is our education system still unequal? Why are mining companies allowed to exploit protected land? Why are our neighborhoods underfunded while the skyline sparkles? They do not want nostalgia. They want accountability, and they are increasingly unafraid to demand it. This generation could be the one to finally close the gap between the Panama that is promised and the Panama that is lived. What remains to be done? Panama has come a long way, from the sacked cities of colonial conquest to the flags raised at the edge of the canal. But history is not destiny, and geography, for all its power, does not guarantee justice. There is still work to be done, honoring the dead of 1964 not just in monuments, but in the living reality of full citizenship for all. Ensuring the canal's revenue feeds schools before banks, hospitals before high-rises. Restoring trust in democracy not through rhetoric, but through results. The land between oceans was never just a route. It was always a reckoning. And now it can become a revelation. A final word, the Isthmus speaks. If the Isthmus could speak, it might say, I have been crossed, carved, controlled. I have watched gold pass and bodies buried. I have heard the cries of the enslaved, the silence of the disappeared, the cheers of the newly free. I am older than empire. I am the land between. And I belong to no one, yet I carry everyone. What will you do with me next? That question now belongs to the people of Panama, to those who built, who resisted, who remembered, to those who walked the streets of Colon, the highlands of Chiriqui, the mangroves of Darien, the markets of San Miguelito. The canal has been returned. Now, the future must be claimed.